Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Thursday. It's October 6th. It's 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. I've been able to speak to you. I have not been able to speak to you for a few days. Back and forth, to and from hospital, and so on and so forth. So we'll try to see what we can do today to catch up with some of the local news and then move on to international items as well. So if you do want to give us a call at 347-201-9201. That's a phone number just for the radio broadcast alone. Now, let's look at some things that have been going on the local stage. well, a real short and sweet message with regard to Yom Kippur, which took place yesterday. And Mayor Mike Spano, the mayor from the city of Yonkers, made the following statement. He says, "At sundown, members of the Jewish faith can take a moment in time to reflect and adjust. Yom Kippur sends a comprehensive message, including acceptance, repentance, and introspection. It is an opportunity to create new beginnings and to leave past faults behind. In this Yom Kippur, which was yesterday, we reflect upon our expectations of ourselves. Let us commit to fulfilling the promise of our values and work, strengthen our family, our community, and our city of Yonkers." So on behalf of the city of Yonkers, he writes, "I wish you a blessed Yom Kippur and an easy fast," which is what I did actually all day yesterday, which was unbelievable. So I was like really shocked I could survive the whole day because I'm a diabetic. So, but nothing untoward happened, so that was really terrific. Anyway, let's look at some other stuff that's taken place. You might want to read Westchester News and Notes, the October 2022 edition, written by Mark Jeffers, and get a wonderful introspective of what's happening around and about Bedford, Westchester County, section of the county itself. So hopefully you'll enjoy that. Then, of course, there was a Yonkers man was indicted for a violent shooting that injured three people in Yonkers. The Westchester County District Attorney, Miriam E. Roca, announced that Yonkers resident Jaquan Henderson, who's 23, was indicted on charges connected with the July 2022 shooting that injured three people in Yonkers. The defendant is being held without bail. So the defendant was indicted by a Westchester County grand jury for 3 months of attempted murder, three counts of attempted murder in the second degree, three counts of assault in the first degree, and two counts of criminal possession of a weapon in the second degree, and criminal possession of a weapon in the third degree, all violent felonies. The defendant was arraigned in Westchester County on October 3rd of 2022. So it seems that on July 16th, at approximately 10:45 p.m., the defendant allegedly shot three people after firing approximately 11 gunshots at a group of individuals on School Street in Yonkers. The victims were transported to area hospitals, where they each underwent emergency treatment. The defendant was apprehended in Lithonia, Georgia, on August 3rd, 2022, by the FBI's Atlanta Metro Major Offender Task Force. Following a collaborative investigation between the Yonkers Police Department, the District Attorney's Office, and the FBI's Westchester Safe Streets Task Force, so the Westchester County Department of Public Safety also assisted the Yonkers Police Department with the arrest. And the case is being It comes before Judge George Rufino in Westchester County, being prosecuted by the Violent Criminal Enterprise Bureau of the Trials and Investigation Bureau. So just so you know, charges against the defendant are merely an accusation, and the defendant is presumed innocent unless and until proven guilty. So we have it, and very, very interesting, to say the least, and also very frightening that things like this happen. Bear with me a moment here. We'll move on to the next page. Okay. This is interesting when it comes to Paul Finer. He's the the commander-in-chief of Greenberg's COVID-19 volunteer angels, and also the Greenberg town supervisor, and a couple of other things as well. So this is the Greenberg Tribune edition. So Greenberg Mayor Paul Finer Esquire introduces the 2022 to 2023 Snow Angels Landscaping Angels Leadership Program. So he requests that people sign up to volunteer, or if you are a senior in need of assistance, with respect to the landscape angels who help seniors with landscaping as of October 23rd and November 19th. So the town of Greenberg is compiling a list of residents who need help, and those residents who will volunteer residents who need such help. So Paul Finer writes, "I'm happy to introduce our new volunteers, exemplary high school students, head of this year's Landscaping Angels and Snow Angels programs, help seniors on a limited budget rake or shovel their lawns and driveways and sidewalks. They are looking for both teenage volunteers to assist their efforts in getting to as many seniors as possible, and for requests from seniors who need help." And in their own words, these are messages from the Landscaping Angels. So someone writes, "My name is Liam Mantini, and I'll be leading Greenberg's Landscaping Angels program this fall. Landscaping Angels asks high schoolers around our area to help volunteer by assisting our senior citizens with their basic landscaping needs, primarily with raking leaves. In hopes to maximize the efficiency of this program, we plan on dedicating 2 days this fall where we will go around responding to any requests for help. And those 2 dates this year are October 23rd and November 19th. I've been an active snow angel for the past 3 years, and to be able to head this new program is rewarding and exciting. So you could sign up as a volunteer or to request help. And you could visit the link below. And you can also email him directly, Liam, L-I-A-M, period, Mantini, M-A-N-T-I-N-I, 35. So it's liam.mantini35@gmail.com. Then we've got a snow angel. His name is Zach Winehouse, and he'll be leading Greenberg's Snow Angels program this winter. The snow angel gathers high schoolers to volunteer and help shovel the driveways and walkways of homeowners who can't do it themselves. So Mr. Winehouse writes, "I've been an active snow angel for the past 3 years and feel prepared and excited to take on this leadership role. And when I'm not shoveling driveways, you could find me playing football or tennis for Ardsley High School or studying for an upcoming test. If you have any questions, you can feel free to reach out to him. His email address is Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, period, Winehouse, W-E-I-N-H-O-U-S-E, at gmail.com. So, Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, period, Winehouse, spelled W-E-I-N-H-O-U-S-E, at gmail.com. And then you could also find links to two simple Google forms, one for volunteers to sign up and another for citizens to request assistance. As always, if you have questions, please do not hesitate to reach out to zachary.winehouse@gmail.com or liammantini35@gmail.com with questions, comments, or suggestions. And if you can't get online and need assistance by phone, you can call the program coordinator, Zach Winehouse, who does the snow. He's a snow angel. You could reach him at 914-839-0301. So again, the number is 914-839-0301. And if you want to reach out to Liam Mantini, who does the landscaping, call him at 914-200-8072. Again, for landscaping and Liam Mantini, 914-200-8072. And go to the Yonkers Tribune website. You'll find the different forms that you can fill out for requesting help for seniors as well as for volunteers to sign up. It's very, very long-winded and complicated, and I probably wouldn't be able to write it all down or even speak so slowly enough for you to get it. But what you should know is that a thank you goes to all the new team leaders for coordinating this incredible service for our seniors. Snow Angels program is starting 32nd year, and the Landscape Angels program is now in their second year. We are so fortunate to have some exceptional students living in our town, writes Paul Feiner, the Greenberg Town Supervisor. What a brilliant idea, and it's been emulated and copied in many other communities around the nation. It's just literally brilliant. So we have that, and let's move on to some other issues as well. One second. I think you'll find this very interesting. Mayor Patterson Howard of Mount Vernon and DoorDash announced a partnership to broaden food access across Mount Vernon as part of the White House Conference on Hunger, Nutrition, and Health. So DoorDash announced a new partnership with Mayor Sean Patterson Howard to help reduce food insecurity across Mount Vernon. This announcement comes as part of the White House's Conference on Hunger, Nutrition, and Health, which is gathering public and private institutions around a coordinated strategy to ultimately end hunger in the U.S. As part of this broader initiative, DoorDash is partnering with 18 mayors across the United States and will support these cities in their efforts to broaden food access by providing $1 million in community credits, gift cards, proprietary DoorDash data on local food access needs, direct funding for in-kind delivery of charitable food, and DoorDash logistics via Project Dash to meet the unique needs of each community. The White House convened the first conference on hunger in over 50 years, DoorDash is announcing a partnership with nearly 20 mayors from across the United States help end hunger for their communities. And DoorDash's Project Dash, which has powered more than 2.5 million deliveries of an estimated over 50 million meals to people in need will support local food banks, food pantries, and other community organizations through delivery technology, data, and gift cards to serve vulnerable populations experiencing food insecurity. As part of their ongoing work to broaden food access, DoorDash is announcing a partnership with 18 mayors across the country to help reduce food insecurity tied to DoorDash's commitment to support in support of the White House Conference on Hunger, Nutrition, and Health. And this is only the second time in history the conference has been held, and DoorDash and local leaders are joining together to advance the conference's goal of solving hunger by 2030. Really fascinating. DoorDash is proud to partner with Mayor John Giles of Mesa, Arizona, Mayor Regina Romero of Tucson, Arizona, Mayor Libby Schaff of Oakland, California, Mayor Patricia Locke Dawson of Riverside, California, Mayor Michael Hancock of Denver, Colorado, Mayor Luke Bronin, Hartford, Connecticut, Mayor Jane Castor of Tampa, Florida, Mayor Andre Dickens of Atlanta, Georgia, Mayor Brandon Scott, Baltimore, Maryland, Mayor Andre Saez of Paterson, New Jersey, Mayor Vic Karstoffen, Camden City, New Jersey, Mayor Kathy Sheen of Albany, New York, and we mentioned, of course, Mayor Sean Patterson Howard of Mount Vernon, New York, Mayor Malik Evans of Rochester, New York, Mayor Andrew Ginther of Columbus, Ohio, Mayor Donald Grabeen of Pawtucket, Rhode Island, Mayor LeVar Stoney of Richmond, Virginia, and Mayor Victoria Woodards of Tacoma, Washington. And DoorDash is going to support these cities in their efforts to broaden food access by providing $1 million in community credits, gift cards, proprietary DoorDash data on local food access needs, direct funding for in-kind delivery of charitable food, and DoorDash logistics via Project Dash to meet the unique needs of each community. One of nine people in Metro Atlanta is living with food insecurity, which should be a call to action for all of us, said Atlanta Mayor Andre Dickens. Partnerships like this like this one with DoorDash allow us to combat food insecurity in our communities and help us build a more resilient, equitable, and inclusive Atlanta. So you get the idea of what this is all about, and you never know if your community was mentioned. It's a great way to help people who have food insecurity, to say the least. Move on to some other issues. Hopefully you'll find of interest. This is a bit disturbing, to say the least. Richard Vincent, a Mount Vernon resident, has been sentenced to 18 years in state prison for a fatal stabbing. Seems that Westchester County District Attorney Mary Emmy Rocha announced that Mount Vernon resident Richard Vincent, who's 43, was sentenced on September 29 of 2022 to 18 years in state prison, with 5 years of post-release supervision for the 2019 fatal stabbing of a Mount Vernon man. So during the evening of March 12th, the defendant cut 39-year-old Randy Streets, wrote and stabbed him multiple times during a physical altercation in the victim's apartment on South 6th Street in Mount Vernon. The next day, the victim's girlfriend found him dead on his bedroom floor and called the police. So following an investigation by the Mount Vernon Police Department, the defendant surrendered himself and was arrested on March 20th, 2019. After a week-long bench trial in April of 2022, the defendant was found guilty of manslaughter in the first degree of violent felony. The case was before Judge George Perfidio in Westchester County Court. Was prosecuted by Bureau Chief Laura Murphy and Assistant District Attorney Elizabeth Marcus, both of the Trials and Investigation Division. So, some of the latest news. Something a little bit more exciting, to say the least, is the Pumpkin Point evidently is returning to Governor's Island on October 22nd. That's something to plan for. The annual Free Pumpkin Patch will bring new programs, family-friendly activities, performances, and more to historic Nolan Park during the final two weekends of October. So the Trust for Governor's Island and the Friends of Governor's Island on the 28th of September announced the return of Pumpkin Point, a free annual pumpkin patch and fall festival on Governor's Island. Located in the historic Nolan Park, Pumpkin Point will bring over 1,000 pumpkins of all shapes and sizes to the island's historic district, transforming the idyllic setting along with its naturally stunning fall foliage over a delightfully automated, delightfully autumnal escape with free programs and activities for visitors of all ages. Visitors are invited to pick up their own pumpkin free with a suggested donation on the weekends of October 22 to 23 and October 29 to 30 of 2022 from 10 in the morning to 5 p.m. Fall is the perfect time to come explore Governor's Island, from beautiful fall foliage to a free pumpkin patch or exciting programming. There is something for everyone, said Claire Newman. She's the president and CEO of the Trust for Governor's Island. Quote, we invite all New Yorkers to hop on the ferry and take on the changing seasons. So it's really fascinating. This year's festivities will include plenty of free fall moments, pumpkin painting, and crafting activities, all taking place October 22 and 23 and October 29 and 30, as well as a rotating schedule of special events and performances from Rising Sun Performance Company, Wonder Spark Puppets, Drag Story Hour, Brooklyn Magic Shop, Flying Reap Productions in collaboration with Governor's Island Tenant Beam Center, the National Park Service, and more to be announced. So a full schedule of each weekend event can be found online at www.govisland.org/pumpkin-point. So, govisland.org/pumpkin-point. Trick-or-treating also returns to Pumpkin Point this year on Sunday, October 30th, which had not been done before. Costumes are encouraged. Food will be available for purchase on site from Governor Island vendors each weekend. So I think that's, hopefully you'll consider going there. It's really quite fun. You could see a full event calendar at www.govisland.org/things-2-do. And that's it. So hopefully you enjoy that. Okay, let's look at some other issues. Bear with me a moment here. In case you haven't read it and it's of importance, there is a special nurse's guide for caring for LGBTQ plus youth. It's an article written by Keith Carlson. And I don't know the definitions of all of these terms that he's associated with and is learning. He's a BSN, an RN, that's a registered nurse, NC-BC. So he talks about the disparities and barriers to care, the best practices for nurses, and the LGBTQ plus resources. So I hope you'll consider reading that if you'll find it of interest. I found it very, very interesting to learn of all these things because you don't really hear that very much. Well, a man in Yonkers pleaded guilty to a hate crime for a violent attack on an Asian senior. So Westchester County District Attorney Miriam Rocha announced that Yonkers resident Tamil Esco, who was 42, pled guilty in late September to committing a violent hate crime on March 2022 against a 67-year-old Asian woman who was entering her apartment building. The defendant cursed at the victim, punched her more than 100 times in and about the head, repeatedly stomped on her upper body and spit on her. Today's agreement secures justice for the brave victim who endured the shocking attack and for a community impacted by the trauma of this hate-driven violence, said D.A. Rocha. Quote, I want to assure every community in Westchester County that my office will use every resource at our disposal to fight hate and hold perpetrators accountable. In addition to vigorously prosecuting these cases, we are continuing our work with our government partners and the community at large to offer training, education, and outreach related to hate crimes and bias incidences. So, that's what it's all about. Unbelievable. Such hatred. I wonder where it comes from. I wouldn't want to know, really, but it's just that these people need a lot of help. Can you imagine a senior citizen spat on and beaten over the head 100 times? And interestingly enough, the guy that did that, he doesn't live in that building. His mother does. And he beat this woman who was just had done some shopping and wanted to get home. It's absolutely astounding that this sort of hatred exists. I don't know where it comes from. I don't want to know where it comes from, other than it's interesting to see and to learn the illness of so many of these people. Literally frightening. I don't know if you heard about this. It seems that Elroy Harris was filmed sexually engaged with a 16-year-old girl in the stairwell of one of the Schroeder Street project buildings. So the Yonkers Tribune contacted Lakeisha Collins Bellamy Esquire, the Yonkers City Council president and an attorney employed by the Municipal Housing Authority with respect to her friend, Lisa McKay Harris, Yonkers Deputy Parks Commissioner, who is presently in the Caribbean, or was last week, in the Caribbean islands of Antigua. It seems that allegations against Mrs. Harris's husband, Elroy Harris, who works for MHA as a custodian, allege that he was filmed engaging sexually with a 16-year-old girl in the stairwell of 333 Schroeder Street, Project Building 3, formerly known as the William A. Schlobohm Houses in the city of Yonkers. and that happened last week. To Yonkers Police Department's 4th Precinct was redirected to police, to a voicemail, and the 4th Precinct has jurisdiction over all the Schroeder Street Project buildings. Roy Harris has lost his employment with MHA. He was fired on Monday, the 26th of September. And when a text inquiry was made of Ms. Collins Bellamy, her text response was, quote, "I am not at liberty to discuss the matter. Ms. Collins Bellamy and Lisa McKay Harris are good friends." So, now let's look at some other things that you may find of interest. This is more of an international issue. This is an article written by Phil Chesler. The article is simply states, Linda Sarsour, Ilhan Omar, have you condemned the Iranian mullahs? Written by Phyllis Chesler. So Sarsour and Omar glorify the wearing of hijab as a religious rite, a tribal identification. But have they condemned the murder of that young Iranian woman by the police for allegedly wearing her hijab improperly? Have they called for sanctions, supported the incredibly brave uprising Iranian women have launched on their behalf? They are burning their hijab, cutting their hair, facing beatings, arrest, and even death. Have they condemned the Iranian mullahs or removed their own hijab? In 2010, Phyllis Chesler argued that the West should ban the burqa and niqab, which is a face veiling. I did not argue for banning hijab, a head carving. It does not obscure one's identity. But now I am rethinking that position. As long as one woman anywhere can be harassed, beaten, arrested, or murdered because of her hijab or her hijab slipped or was seen as improperly worn, no woman should wear a hijab. When all women are free to wear or not to wear a head covering, then and only then might women choose what is right for them. And that's very, very compelling and telling. Which is interesting because in Iran, while women began the, the demonstrations against the administration there, men have joined women and emboldened women as they embolden themselves to literally admonish the administration there for their conduct. So something very, very important is happening there. We'll see what the outcome is eventually. Let me just quickly look at this. This has expired, so there's no point in repeating it to you at the moment. Okay. I think that covers our local stuff. Bear with me a moment here. Ian, evidently Biden and DeSantis put politics aside for the Florida cleanup. The U.S. President Joe Biden, while on a visit to hard-hit Florida, said that reconstruction efforts could take months or even years. He promised to continue federal support, quote, after the television cameras had moved on, end quote. The Democratic U.S. President Joe Biden met with Republican Florida Governor Ron DeSantis on Wednesday to tour the devastation from Hurricane Ian. During his visit to Florida, Biden stressed the need for a unified federal and state effort for the lengthy cleanup and recovery. He said, today, we have one job and only one job, and that's to make sure that people in Florida get everything they need to fully, thoroughly recover, said Biden in Fort Myers, which bore the brunt of Ian's assault. At least 75 people in Florida were killed by Ian. The president surveyed the destruction from a helicopter and said reconstruction would take months or even years. Later, after the television cameras have moved on, we're still going to be here with you, he added. So we appreciate working together. DeSantis has been one of Biden's most vocal critics, and he is seen as a potential contender to be the next Republican presidential candidate. But the two politicians made a point to put politics aside on Wednesday. Biden and First Lady Jill Biden were greeted by DeSantis and his wife, Casey, in the waterfront neighborhood of Fisherman's Wharf. Mr. President, welcome to Florida, the Republican governor said. We appreciate working together. Biden later added, we have very different political philosophies, but we've worked hand in hand and we've worked hand in glove. So Biden's disaster response to a change in messaging from the Republican predecessor, Donald Trump, who at times threatened to withhold federal disaster aid from Democratic governors who criticized him. Well, the president's visit to Florida comes just days after surveying the damage in Puerto Rico from Hurricane Fiona, where he had a similar message of unity and support. Oh, God. Unbelievable disaster. Get used to this sort of weather pattern around the world. Very, very frightening. Now let's look at some other things that you may find of interest. One second here. Okay. In the Brazil election, a third-place candidate has endorsed Lula ahead of the runoff. Simone Tebet, her voters, to back Lula due to his, quote, commitment to democracy, end quote. Former President Fernando Henrique Cardoso also endorsed his leftist former rival. The former Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has received two major endorsements as his campaign prepares for a runoff election against far-right incumbent Jair Bolsonaro on October 30. Simone Tebet, the center-right candidate, who came in third place during the first round with 4% of the vote, called on the 5 million people who voted for her to back Lula in the second round. Quote, for my love for Brazil, for democracy and for the Constitution, for the courage I never lacked, I apologize to my friends and companions who begged for neutrality in the second round, Tebet told reporters in Sao Paulo. What is at stake is far greater than each of us. Tebet, an anti-abortion Catholic, was popular among some conservative voters and women. Analysts say her endorsement of Lula is a symbolic win for the leftist who was president from 2003 to 2010. I maintain my criticism of Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, she added, but I will give him my vote because I recognize his commitment to democracy and the Constitution, which I have never seen from the current president, Jair Bolsonaro. So a former president also backs Lula. On the same day, former president Fernando Henrique Cardoso, who is still respected in business circles, announced that he too would cast his vote for Lula's history of struggle for democracy and social inclusion, said over Bolsonaro. The 91-year-old posted photos of himself with a young Lula distributing pro-democracy pamphlets during the military dictatorship that lasted from 1964 to 1985. Lula was defeated by Cardoso at the 1994-1998 presidential election until he eventually won against a different candidate in 2002. Lula was leading in the polls, in an opinion poll released on Wednesday by IPEC found that Lula had 51% voter support compared to 43% for Bolsonaro. The poll surveyed 2,000 with an error margin of 2 percentage points. However, IPEC, IPEC, and other pollsters also projected that Lula would have a more decisive lead over Bolsonaro than the slimmer margins that actually eventuated during the first round. So after this better than expected result on Sunday, Bolsonaro told reporters, "We beat the lie. Now," he continued, "the campaign is ours." He said, "I'm completely confident." That was the story in Brazil. Sorry, I have a very bad cold. Let's look what's happening on the international stage. Iran's regime struggles to end the hijab protests. In schoolgirls have now joined the mass protest over the death of a young woman in police custody. These are some of the biggest anti-regime rallies that Iran has witnessed in recent years. An activist says, "I'm in awe of the ordinary women protesting Iran's regime. There has been no let up in the anti-government protests that have been sweeping Iran. The unrest by the death of Mahsa Amini, a 22-year-old woman who died last month in the custody of the strict religious police. Azadeh Pulzand is a human rights researcher who has extensively studied women's rights movements in Iran. We asked her what's different this time around." This is what she said. Bear with me.
Yeah, thank you. I think that the women's rights movement in Iran is basically over 100 years old. So it's I see the movement that we see today on the streets, the protests, as a continuation of many years of resistance and struggling against the discriminatory policies of the Islamic Republic, but also a continuation of the protest movement against the government and its violation of multiplicity of rights that we've seen in terms of protests since 2017-2018. In terms of women's participation, you see women in many protests in contemporary Iran, and quite actively so, but I think in it being so gendered this time, and women's rights not only being about women's rights, but being so intertwined with the political grievances and and the political demands of an entire nation is unique. So, for example, in the revolution, women were present in the revolution of 1979, but men say that there were no such gender demands from the previous government.
Would you say that women taking the lead in this protest movement is a sign of a greater shift in Iranian society?
I think that women taking the lead in this protest is a sign of the Iranian people's maturity. So women and the Iranian people that have reached the point that they do not think that freedom is attainable without women's rights. And women's feeling dignified in Iran, and that women's rights is not attainable under the current regime, under the Islamic Republic. So therefore, women's rights and freedom, and along with it, a series of other rights, socioeconomic and civil political rights, have come together on the street with women at the center of it, demanding for essentially what I think is a better future, a more dignified future, and also highlighting here the role of the youth alongside women.
It is very dangerous for those participating in the protest to publicly talk about their part in the movement and the repression they've suffered at the hands of the authorities. You're in Portugal, but I bet you're in touch with a lot of people back home. Would you mind telling us what you're hearing?
Okay, so we don't have that part of the comment. Bear with me a moment. Oh, there it is.
Yes, what I'm mostly in awe of is the ordinary people who before, for example, on my social media, I've never seen them putting anything political, remotely political. You know, even posting, for example, like a letter that they have received from the court to attend as a result of having attended the protest, or very bluntly, you know, posting anti-government slogans and so on whenever they have access to the very limited internet. Activists in particular are in a very difficult situation because the Iranian regime is not only arresting people who are on the street, they're actually going after people that they consider maybe influential in the expansion of these protests, so whether they're journalists, authors, activists, and so on, and they arrest them from home. So, for example, I know a few activists personally who are currently in jail and nobody knows of their exact whereabouts.
This is currently a leaderless movement. Is that an advantage or a disadvantage?
I would say it's yet to be seen, but it has pros and cons. What I think is so hopeful about this movement is that it's so grassroots, it's so organic, and I think that's what makes it very powerful, very collective in a way. In terms of it not having a leader, my worry is because of the very systematic and systemic repression and the violence of the Islamic Republic against the people, against the protesters, and the use of lethal force even, if there was a leader, maybe there could be more strategy on what's next. But at the same time, I feel that we have to trust those incredible young leaders on the ground and the trust that they're very strategic about what they're doing and that they know better than us what their next move will be, and to honor and respect whatever it is that they will do next. For example, they have taken the process on to strike. I think there is a lot of wisdom behind that, and that's leadership. It just may not be individual-based leadership. It's more like a collective grassroots level of leadership.
How important is it for this grassroots movement that it be covered by the media around the world?
I think it's critical. It's absolutely critical because the way I talk about it is that why is the Islamic Republic shutting down the internet, restricting the internet so seriously and so severely every time there is a protest in recent years in Iran? Because they don't want the world to know. because they want to be able to kill people without the world knowing about it. And so they don't want the world to watch. And when the world watches, I think it does, in the long run, give some level of protection to the individuals who are risking their lives. Some, I mean, at least there's a little bit of a fear then in the Islamic Republic that, you know, that the, what they're doing will have consequences. But also, you know, Iranian women, youth, and Iranian people really want to be heard by the world because they don't think that they're going to ever be heard by their own government. And so if the world hears it, perhaps places like the UN and other multilateral organizations, countries like Germany, would think more seriously about holding the Islamic Republic accountable for its atrocities.
There you have it. Let's look at some stuff that's from an ecological point of view. Evidently, saving central Java is taking root by planting mangroves. The United Nations says that climate catastrophes will uproot 143 million people across Asia over the next decades. Rising seas are already inundating some coastal parts of Indonesia. Reforestation could help, but that won't overnight, and the tide is already high. So listen to this, only about 2 minutes long. One second.
But the tide keeps coming in. The walls are moldy, and from time to time, the water rises to the level of her hips. If the tide is too high, the family is trapped inside for hours. Kasimi's daughter has had enough.
I want to live someplace that isn't like this. Somewhere with more land and that's dry. Hopefully somewhere that's safe from floods. Her grandfather remembers the times the cars and motorcycles were driving at the main street.
The village was nothing like this. It was just dry land. It was lush, lots of vegetation. It became like this 10 years ago.
The villagers cut down mangrove forests that were protecting the coastline. And this is not the only reason for the catastrophe. Global warming and rising sea levels are threatening the whole area. Asiya used to live in Monduliko, a village nearby. Today, she needs a boat to access her village, make the structures lead to her former home. Asiya just came to pick up some of her personal belongings.
Of course I miss home, but what can I do? It's not habitable anymore.
She had no other choice than to move to the next city, dropping her house for a one-bedroom concrete apartment, but at least she has dry feet here.
Yeah, people are walking in their homes and it's wet. You know, some even as high up to their knees. It's absolutely amazing what's going on all over the world. So we're lucky very much that we're able to, it's not happening here, but it could conceivably happen, and very, very interesting. Let's look at something that you might find interesting as well. Evidently, there's an effort to preserve the memories of children that were killed in Auschwitz. So of the 6 million people murdered in the Holocaust, more than a million of them were killed in Auschwitz-Birkenau. Almost a quarter of those were children. Listen to this.
Carrying those whose last steps led here, the mountain of shoes at Auschwitz-Birkenau, especially those from Little Feet, is a sight no one can forget. But few visitors to the former Nazi death camp will have to remember what survivor Arya Pinsker does.
This is all that's left of these children. I'm wondering if some are from one of my siblings.
Pinsker recalls the day he and his family arrived here from his village in Transylvania after days of inhumane transport. He was sent with his older brothers in a different line from his parents and younger siblings. Since Grass, the boy who'd been there longer, where he could rejoin his family, came out after the shower they'd been told they were taking.
He said, "You don't know?" He pointed up to the chimneys, said, "See the smoke? That's where they came out."
Now 92, he frequently shares his story here and all over the world to help keep alive the memories of those who didn't make it. But the tangible remnants of their lives are crumbling with age, even as preservation experts work desperately to save them. A new effort is underway now to restore 8,000 shoes from children killed at Auschwitz. It's called Soul to Soul, funded in part by organizations like that of Eitel Nashlis, who calls this his duty to his grandmother, who survived the Holocaust.
So one shoe that had the word Cinderella at the bottom of my foot, who was the Cinderella in that shoe? And who are the princes in that shoe? And so they're remarkable stories. And I really hope that we will do an exceptional job to draw those stories out, and most importantly, to share them with the entire world.
As one of just a handful of children to have left these barracks alive, Arya Pinsker laments the world seems not to have learned the lessons of horror's past.
The new human hatred is still everywhere. You only have to see what is happening in Ukraine with Putin. Understand that when there is a dictator who can decide anything, anything can happen.
Making sure these shoes survive isn't just to remember the children who didn't. To help guide the steps of those who will make tomorrow.
Well, so, very, very powerful report. One second, I lost my place. This is very interesting as well. Women are finding their voice and they're fighting back. The Afghan women are defying deadly attacks in a fight for education. The women in Afghanistan are refusing to be silenced despite mounting repression under the Taliban, and many girls can no longer go to school or attend university. And the Taliban have failed to protect women and minority groups from lethal attacks by other militant groups. Listen to this. Unbelievable.
Dozens of young women standing up for their right to be better protected. They have an education. Taliban officials wield sticks to break up the crowd. Then gunfire is heard and the women scramble in panic. The protests were in response to a bomb attack on a private education center in Kabul. A suicide bomber blew himself up in the women's section of a gender-segregated hall where students were preparing for university entrance exams. Most of the victims were girls and young women who belonged to the minority Hazara community. 19-year-old Wahia was in the classroom when the attack happened. Two of her friends and the teacher were killed. She managed to escape. She says she won't be intimidated.
The only thing we have is education. Education is our weapon. I don't want to take this weapon from us. I want to study law and management and diplomacy because I want to be an influential politician.
Likewise, yeah. Umal Banin also had big ambitions. Now her photos and her school books are all her family have left of her.
My daughter used to joke with me and say, "I will study until one day I become president or a lawyer and serve the people of Afghanistan." But she was martyred.
Umal Banin was one of the young women killed in the attack. Her family pray at her grave. And her sister vows that she won't give up.
We're really worried. It is hard for us. All the schools are closed for girls. This is very painful. But we will continue with the lessons and we will never give up or stop.
Even brutal attacks like this one haven't crushed the resolve of young Afghan women to keep up their fight for an education.
Amazing. Literally amazing. Okay, well, let's just quickly look. One minute here. All right, let me move on to some other sites. Bear with me a second. Okay. Now, let's just see what else is happening here. We'll move on to 1 minute. Let me see if we can have this here. All right. Oh. Yes, let's cover this because I haven't caught up yet with this. Evidently, Ukraine is claiming rapid advances in the south and the east. Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed laws formalizing the incorporation of 4 Ukrainian regions that were illegally annexed after a series of discredited votes. Unperturbed by that, Ukrainian forces are making, quote, fast and powerful advances, says President Volodymyr Zelensky. Listen to this. Bear with me a moment. Okay, it should be coming up.
Ukrainian control as a result of recent advances. The blue and yellow flag is also back flying overhead here in the strategic eastern city of Lyman as locals queue for aid. Ukrainian troops retook the key hub in the Donetsk region over the weekend, just hours after Russia's President Putin announced the illegal annexation of the whole region. Signs of the fierce battle fought here recently, as well as the months of Russian occupation, are everywhere. With Russian troops forced to retreat here and across the south and east, and with a chaotic military mobilization sparking widespread criticism, Putin said that changes would be made to the conscription rules for students. But despite all the recent setbacks, Moscow hasn't lost its power to strike far beyond the front lines, as residents of this city, just 85 kilometers south of Kyiv, were reminded on Wednesday.
I woke up to a buzzing sound. I woke up and I heard that sound getting closer and closer, and somewhere near my house, it exploded.
According to officials, at least 6 so-called kamikaze drones struck buildings, including an army base in the area, injuring 1 person. While Moscow has ramped up its use of suicide drones, which Kyiv claims are Iranian-made, since September, Wednesday's attack was the closest they've come to the Ukrainian capital.
Okay. All right, let's look at what else is happening. I think you may find this really interesting. And the question is, what has changed in 60 years of James Bond? Well, in 1962, a martini-drinking womanizer saved the world from a villain, for the first time in Dr. No. And much has changed since the initial film, from the role of Bond girls to 007's machismo. And here are a few dated aspects. On October 5 of 1962, the movie Dr. No premiered in London. It was the first in a long and successful series based on the spy novels by author Ian Fleming. Playing the leading role, Agent 007 was an unknown actor, his name Sean Connery. In the film, he was first introduced to his character as he sits in a casino across from an attractive woman to gamble away her fortune. When she asks 007 his name, the camera pans to Bond lighting a cigarette with a smoldering look in his eye. He utters the legendary words, Bond, James Bond. Shortly thereafter in the film, 007 receives an assignment to fly to Jamaica and investigate the murder of another M16 agent. He eventually tracks down a Chinese-German criminal scientist who is bent on destroying the United States space program and achieving world domination. Not a matter of East or West, Dr. No tells Bond when he asks, both are just points of a compass, one as stupid as the other. In principle, this story is the basis of all of the 25 James Bond films. Whether the villain is Dr. No, Blofeld, Goldfinger, or Le Chiffre, for one thing, world domination. But to do so, you have to get past James Bond, whose gunfire and wild chase scenes inevitably spoil their plans. Well, a machismo problem. Although many fan forums consider Dr. No to be one of the best Bond films, the movie would never be made in the same way today. Firstly, one could write entire books about the omnipresent sexism and machismo that the character James Bond has displayed over the decades. Certainly, there would have to be a thick chapter dedicated to the women in his films, who are typically portrayed as naive, willingly flinging themselves into Bond's arms, seeking protection. Sometimes there are sophisticated female antagonists who lose control as a sort of hopping into bed with a secret agent, with a friend of foe, or foe. Each film had at least one Bond girl, and often more. A total of 60 love interests have appeared in the film. Their names, like Honey or Pussy Galore, would never be acceptable today. In more recent decades, female roles in Bond films have changed, as has Bond himself. In the last 5 years, in which Daniel Craig has played Bond, he is seen as a man who is tough on the outside and soft on the inside, and who is not always lucky with women. Aside from the portrayal of women, there are also plenty of other details in Dr. No that haven't quite stood the test of time. Well, there's a questionable lifestyle choices. Another sign of the zeitgeist in the 1962 film is that everyone smokes, which is a no-no by today's Hollywood standards. Cigarettes are found everywhere in the old film, from the casino to the hotel bar and even the bathroom. Smoking was commonplace in the United States in the 1970s, so naturally this came across on the silver screen. In the 1970s TV series Space 1999, people were even depicted smoking on the moon. But by the 2000s, smoking was largely banned in many parts of the world, due to its health risks. One can also note in Dr. No that few people were wearing seatbelts when Bond drives off in his sports car to visit a woman. He is followed and a chase scene ensues. Bond, notably, is not wearing a seatbelt. His pursuers eventually drive off a cliff and die. Of course, after all, they aren't wearing seatbelts either, and cars didn't have airbags at the time. The vehicle explodes, prompting 007 to say they were obviously in a hurry to get to their funeral. But that's hilarious. Well, so why are all the secretaries women? That's a good question, too. In the older Bond films, all secretaries and receptionists are played by women, which in the 1960s was considered standard female jobs. Well, whether redheaded, blonde, or brunette, secretaries are Bond's favorite targets for womanizing, and they are all susceptible to his charms. Throughout most Bond films, the agent has a romantic tension with Moneypenny, his boss's secretary, something which was not described in the original books. In the 2012 film Skyfall, Moneypenny is given a first name, Eve, and we finally learn her backstory. In this film, she is no longer a hopeless secretary in love, but a top-trained agent who accidentally shoots Bond and is reassigned to desk duty as punishment. In any case, today, Moneypenny's job title would probably be office manager or executive assistant rather than secretary. Inappropriate casting. In the film Dr. No tells Bond that he is the child of a British missionary and a Chinese woman from an upstanding family. However, the character is portrayed by Canadian actor Joseph Wiseman, who is wearing makeup to make his eyes look more Asian. While it used to be the norm in such movies to have East Asian characters played by white actors, today these cases of yellow face are frowned upon, just as it would be to wear black face, putting black makeup on one's skin to portray a black person. If there was a Dr. No remake in the future, a Chinese actor would be more likely to play in his role. It is, however, a global heritage. In the film, black Jamaicans call white Englishman captain. When the film was shot, Jamaica was still a British crown colony. It did not gain independence until August of 1962, 2 months before Dr. No was released. They are still treated like second-class citizens in terms of language used in the film. In the German-dubbed version, for example, Jamaicans are addressed as natives, language which is considered highly discriminatory today. And there's one place, one last change to be made. In the British Embassy in Jamaica, there's a portrait of a young queen's Queen Elizabeth. In the next James Bond, should there be one, a picture of King Charles III would hang in its place. So very, very fascinating to say the least. Well, from chauvinist to anti-hero, the movie version of 007 has been at Her Majesty's service for almost 60 years. The creators have repeatedly reinvented the character, adapting Bond to the spirit of the times. In Berlin's Madame Tussauds Wax Museum, you can admire all six actors who have played Bond, and there was Roger Moore, Timothy Dalton, Daniel Craig, Sean Connery, George Lazenby, and Pierce Brosnan. Amazing. What a history. What a history. Well, I'm old enough to remember the James Bond series with the one and only James Bond, Sean Connery. So, one second. One moment here. This is amazing. I would never have expected it, but in Mexico, a mayor killed in a town hall massacre. An attack in the southern town of San Miguel Totolapan has left at least 18 people dead, including the mayor. And police say the motive behind the killings is still unknown. Gunmen on Wednesday killed at least 18 people and wounded two others in the southern Mexican town, including the local mayor, according to authorities. State prosecutor Sandra Luz Valdovinos told Milenio Television that the attack took place at the town hall in San Miguel Totolapan in Guerrero State. So far, we have 18 confirmed dead, Maldovinos told. The motive for the killings was not immediately clear. But there are things that we do know about the attack. The attack is alleged to have been carried out by the Los Tequileros gang, which is affiliated to a powerful drug cartel. Local media reported that the gunman targeted the town hall in broad daylight. Footage and photos from the scene show the municipal building's bullet-riddled walls. According to Valdovinos, Mayor Conrado Mendoza and his father, who was himself a former mayor, were among the dead. Police officers and city council workers were also killed. And the prosecutor's office said that to local media. Town, with its population of around 4,300 people, has a history of violence involving drug cartels. On Saturday, one second, one moment here. Well, in 2016, disgruntled locals set up with abductions carried out by the Los Tequileros gang, kidnapped the gang leader's mother. The gang's influence had waned in recent years following the death of one of its leaders during a 2018 gunfight with local authorities. So that's the story that took place there. Very frightening sort of stuff. One second. Okay. All right, so let me just see what else is here. I think that that's it for us today. Okay. Just look and see one other thing. Bear with me a moment. No, I think that we've really covered all that we can for today. So hopefully you'll join us tomorrow. and we'll see what we have to close the week out with the latest news at that time. So thank you for being with us today. All the best to you. Let me get back to our studio screen. And thank you for being with us, and we'll say goodbye. Enjoy the day and be well. Goodbye. One second. Okay, here we are.